professor John Dewey, wanted to focus the school curriculum around the social studies so that we could tie the other subject areas into the service of what's most important, which is our social world, right? Our human world that we live in. And so they would take a social problem like homelessness or violence or poverty, and they would put that at the center of the curriculum, and then the skills from all the subject areas would lend themselves to learning the skills needed to address that problem of concern. And I'd like to see a little more of that be brought back so that students learn, we would never hear again, you know, why do I need to know this, or what's this for? That students would learn that the things they're learning in school have meaning for the world outside of school and for their place in that world. We need to teach kids that democracy is not a spectator sport. It's something that you have a say in, that you have a role in shaping history. And I think we need to bring schools back to that traditional public purpose of public education. You know, Thomas Jefferson said that if the citizenry is not well educated enough to govern their own affairs, then the solution is not to take that power of governance away from them, but rather to educate them. And that's really where the founding of our public schools came from, was the idea that you needed an educated population in order to have a well-functioning democracy.
Well, those are about all the questions that I have. I don't know if there's anything else that you'd like to add, or if you think we kind of covered most of it.
I think it's pretty good.
Great. Well, yeah, thanks again for speaking with me today, Joel. This is really helpful, and I really enjoyed your book.
Great. Well, I'm really glad to talk to you about it. It was a lot of fun.
Again, this was Joel Westheimer, author of What Kind of Citizen? On Political Perspectives.
And you're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO, KBOO.Portland. Next up, we hear an interview with Guardian environmental reporter Suzanne Goldenberg about Exxon and the link between its operations and climate change. And be sure and stay tuned at 10 for Air Cascadia, at 10:15 Flashpoints, at 11 o'clock, we got the food show.
This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
These ideas of energy poverty, energy colonialism, these are just various ideas and arguments that have been in circulation for a long time. They really coalesce around the same very broad strategy, that is to, one, create doubts about the existence of climate change, about the gravity of the threat posed by climate change, and two, block action on climate change.
Children learn that lying is wrong, often in kindergarten. Apparently, somewhere on the road to becoming corporate leaders, they unlearn that lesson, especially if they're running multinational oil companies. Today on Sea Change Radio, we talk with Suzanne Goldenberg, who's been leading the charge in explaining the significance of an email which shows Exxon has been aware of the link between its operations and climate change for quite some time. As one of the leading environmental journalists today, Goldenberg puts the email and the subsequent climate denial campaign in context. We talk about the history of climate change awareness, the responsibilities of large fossil fuel companies like ExxonMobil, and the devastating environmental consequences of a corporation that plays fast and loose with the truth. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Suzanne Goldenberg. She's the U.S. environment correspondent for The Guardian. Suzanne, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So you have a terrific piece in The Guardian entitled Exxon Knew of Climate Change in 1981, but it funded deniers for 27 more years. First, why don't you tell us a little bit more about this email and why it's important?
Well, what we've got and what the story is based on is an email that was written in October last year by the in-house climate expert at Exxon for 30 years. So he's a retired gentleman who's now recollecting events that happened in the early 1980s. And the key part of this is that as early as 1981, according to Exxon's former in-house climate expert, the company knew about climate change and was factoring climate change into its calculations, its economic thinking, when it was considering the development of a natural gas field off the coast of Indonesia. So that predates what many people suppose is the time when oil companies first began to get really concerned about climate change.
And you can't help but draw parallels with the tobacco industry as we learn more and more about how much the tobacco industry knew about the connection between cancer and smoking, and yet did nothing, and actually fought against this information coming to light. Is that a fair parallel?
There are lots of parallels here. I mean, the same kind of spin doctors that were working for the tobacco industry then, many of those same people now are working for the energy industry. But I want to just give you an idea of the time scales involved.
Sure, please do.
For example, scientists and oncologists knew as early as the 1930s that smoking caused cancer. They knew in the Second World War that smoking caused cancer. But really, it took until the 1990s and a whistleblower at the tobacco companies and a huge series of lawsuits before it became clear to everyone that smoking caused cancer and that the tobacco companies not only knew this from their own very sophisticated in-house scientific research, but they constructed a whole sort of spin cycle industry around denying this so they could go on knowingly selling products that killed people.
You quote Naomi Oreskes in your piece. We just had her on earlier this year as her book Merchants of Doubt came out, which was kind of drawing that same parallel that we're discussing right now.
That's right. I mean, she has gone into that very clearly. In the case of the oil companies like Exxon, we aren't there yet in terms of the discovery of knowledge or in terms of what they knew, when they knew it, the extent of the research. But what historians like Naomi Oreskes are beginning to find out is that the knowledge about climate change goes back far earlier than many people imagine, and it was much more widespread. So according to her research, which I'm not sure if she's published yet, but she's told me about it, you know, that the White House was thinking about climate change and worried about climate change under LBJ, under Nixon, under Carter. And she is convinced that Exxon certainly knew about climate change in 1981 when it was considering this field and, you know, the events that I talk about in my story that ran in The Guardian, and that other oil companies knew about climate change and the causes of climate change also in the 1980s.
Now, I want to dig into the Natuna project, which is this Indonesian gas field that's in question a little later. But first, why don't you take a step back and what can we learn about Leni Bernstein, the person whose email your article is largely based on? He seems like a very interesting character.
Leni Bernstein seems like a very, very interesting character, and he clearly played a very important role at Exxon and Mobil for a very long time. I wish I could tell you exactly what he did, but Leni Bernstein is very shy of talking to reporters, and he has not responded to my request for an interview. What we do know, however, is that, as he claims in this email that is posted now on an Ohio University website, and you can link to it from my Guardian story, is that he spent 30 years at the oil industry. He's a chemist by training. He worked in his climate scientist for Exxon. And so he was involved in a lot of the research and about climate change, quite obviously, in his role. Politically, what we know from other reporting is that he was also involved much, you know, he operated outside of the organization. Leni Bernstein was a lead author on two of the United Nations blockbuster science reports, the IPCC reports. And those reports are seen as the gold standard of climate science, you know, a collection of all of the science up until that point. So he helped produce two of those. And from other scientists at the time, their argument is that it was industry scientists like Leni Bernstein who tried to steer the conversation away from the connection between fossil fuels and climate change and to interject some doubt about the causes of climate change.
And in the email to Alyssa Bernstein from Ohio University, and I gather there's no relation.
No relation.
There.
It's kind no relation.
Of pure coincidence. He talks about one of the villains in the what got us here in terms of climate change denial. And one of these villains was his employer. He says the Global Climate Coalition, the GCC, was a trade organization of energy producers and large energy users. He writes, I was involved in GCC for a while, unsuccessfully trying to get them to recognize scientific reality. Was this a Sisyphean task that he had taken on, or is he being disingenuous? Like somebody who would work for a trade organization, but was he really a rebel within this organization or not, from your research about him?
I think it's important to remember that Leni Bernstein is now in his mid-70s. He's looking back at events that happened in his career, you know, very many years ago, decades ago. And I think he's looking back now and reflecting on his life. And I think he's also looking back now on the benefit of hindsight and trying to think about his own place in history. I think there's also obviously a question of memory and memory not being perfect. Nobody remembers things exactly as they happen. But I think if you look at that email, he also has a very interesting sentence where he says that Exxon never really questioned the potential of fossil fuels to cause climate change. It just questioned the validity of the science. And that's some very fancy footwork. For example, I have the potential to be a supermodel. I have the potential to be an astronaut. But is that valid? So I think he's leaving himself some wiggle room even now.
Precisely. And that's what they did. Let's dive into how Exxon denied the validity of the science over several decades.
Right. I mean, and by this, I am using Exxon's own claims. You know, in a corporate report in 2007, it said it would discontinue funding to groups that promote climate denial, which, you know, using Exxon's own statements means that for 27 years, they did provide funding to groups that promote climate denial. And these were a variety of groups. You're talking about researchers, you're talking about free market think tanks, you're talking about activist groups. But over the years, there's very considerable amounts of money. According to Greenpeace, which has researched this very closely, Exxon has spent above $30 million trying to discredit the science underlying climate change and trying to block action on climate change.
And yet they're ahead of many of our politicians and many Americans when the Exxon spokesman in your piece is quoted as saying, we do not fund or support those who deny the reality of climate change. That's encouraging on one hand, but also I couldn't help but think it's kind of pathetic that Exxon is ahead of so many American thought leaders on this issue at this point.
Well, if you look at the polling shows that the percentage of Americans who accept the reality of climate change and who are concerned about climate change is growing. It's moving upwards. Unfortunately, if you look at Congress, you know, our the elected officials, a majority of Republicans in Congress continue to deny the existence of climate change and continue to oppose that will help fight climate change. So there's a big disconnect also between, there's a disconnect between the science and Republicans in Congress, but there's also a disconnect between the rest of the country and Republicans in Congress on the issue of climate change.
The sorry eyes cut through bone make it hard to leave you alone, leave you here, wearing your wounds, waving your guns, somebody new. Baby, I'll Baby, I'll lost. Baby, I'll lost.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to environmental journalist Suzanne Goldenberg. She is the U.S. environment correspondent for The Guardian. People can follow her at theguardian.com or on Twitter. Her handle is at S-U-Z-Y-J-I. So, Suzanne, walk us through the timeline, if you will, from 1981 to mid-90s when Exxon was battling hard to try to keep the U.S. from being a signatory to the Kyoto Protocol. Why is the fact that they knew of climate change, according to Lenny Bernstein in 1981, so important?
Well, there is this idea that climate change should not really become a political issue in the U.S. until 1988. And that is when the climate scientist James Hansen gave testimony to Congress and said, climate change is occurring, it's a threat, and it's happening right now. And that is seen, which is widely accepted, as a sort of watershed moment for climate change. So why this email is significant, why the recollections of Lenny Bernstein are significant, is that it shows that Exxon was concerned about climate change far earlier, and it was concerned about the economic implications of climate change. It was already beginning to think, ooh, what happens if there's regulations to stop us from doing something that would cause the release of greenhouse gas emissions? This gas field off Indonesia was 70% carbon dioxide. So Exxon was thinking even then, wow, that's a lot, awful lot of CO2 to be venting into the atmosphere. Indeed, at the time, it would have been the single biggest point source of carbon dioxide. But they thought that it could also expose them to costs if there were environmental regulations.
And as Bernstein writes, these scientists and management is looking at this from a very long-term perspective, 30, 50, even 100 years down the road.
That's right. I mean, that's absolutely right. You know, oil and the oil and gas business is a very long-term business, very expensive to go in and start drilling. So you want to, if you're a company, you want to be sure you can continue producing and producing at a certain stable cost as long as you can.
And give us an idea of that 70% CO2 number from the Natuna gas field. How does that stack up to some of the largest today?
I think at the time, according to Lenny Bernstein, it would have been the single biggest point source of carbon dioxide emissions. I cannot do the math in my head to tell you how it would compare to the other oil, gas, and tar sands fields that have been opened up since then. I think the email suggests that our sources of carbon emissions that are even greater. You know, the Arctic, for example, that would have been unthinkable in the 1980s. But I mean, this summer, you're going to have Shell going up to drill in the Arctic. And that is seen as the largest single potential source of greenhouse gas emissions if it's all drilled.
And does this gas field in Indonesia lay untapped today?
Absolutely. That's a really fascinating thing. I tried to talk to Exxon about this. But they won't really go over their thinking. But it seems that it periodically over the years since 1981, Exxon and other companies, including the Indonesian state-owned company, have looked at developing Natuna because it is so rich in natural gas, but they have never actually gotten it off the ground because of fears about climate change, because of prices. Oil prices have crashed, gas prices have crashed.
Let's go through some of the Exxon management and how things transformed. Clifton Garvin was the CEO of Exxon in 1981. He was actually from 75 to 1986. But things changed quite a bit under Lee Raymond. He was very much in the climate change denying camp. Today, it's Rex Tillerson, who's a little bit more in touch with reality, it seems. But let me read you a quote from Lee Raymond in October of 1997, when he was delivering a speech to the 15th World Petroleum Congress in China. He was quoted as saying, "The most pressing environmental problems of the developing nations are related to poverty, not global climate change. Addressing these problems will require economic growth, and that will necessitate increasing, not curtailing, the use of fossil fuels." Maybe you can give us some other examples of how Lee Raymond and his management team worked against the climate change science community of the 90s.
I mean, it's striking how little different it is today in some ways. And I want to be clear that this isn't about Lee Raymond and it's not about one company. Although, of course, you know, Exxon, as the world's biggest privately held oil company, does stand above the others. But that argument that the issue really is energy poverty of developing countries, and it's about escaping from poverty and you need cheap energy to escape from poverty for developing countries, that is exactly the same argument that is being made today by, for example, Peabody Energy, which is a coal company. So these themes go away and they come back. And, you know, the idea of energy poverty goes away and comes back. You've got Shell, I think, talks about energy colonialism. These ideas of energy poverty, energy colonialism, these are just various ideas and arguments that have been in circulation for a long time. And they really coalesce around the same very broad strategy. That is to, one, create doubts about the existence of climate change, about the gravity of the threat posed by climate change, and to block action on climate change, block anything that would require cutting the greenhouse gas emissions that cause climate change, because that would impose a cost on the industry. That's basically what's going on, whether you call it energy poverty, energy colonialism, or something else.
And how did Exxon, let's just stay on Exxon, I know they're not the only players in this, but just using them as an example of how big oil injected themselves into the climate debate. Can you chronicle a little bit and give our listeners a little better idea of how Exxon worked through, let's say, the American Petroleum Institute?
Well, the American Petroleum Institute is the main lobby group for the energy industry, and it has been one of the big opponents of efforts to bring in legislation that would help the U.S. fight climate change. And, you know, Exxon, as a big oil company, has been a big backer of API. So have all the other oil companies. So if you go back to 2009, since Obama's been in the White House, the American Petroleum Institute has been one of the biggest single opponents of his efforts to deal with climate change. They've taken out ad campaigns. They've had rallies, they've gone on TV, they are out there with a constant voice sort of attacking Obama's efforts to fight climate change, demanding that he free up the industry to go drill for oil and gas through fracking, and that he open up drilling in the Arctic and off the Atlantic and Pacific coast. So it's been there pushing very hard for expanded operations of the oil and gas industry. And if you look around, I would say that they have succeeded to a great extent in delaying regulations of this industry. It's one of the last sectors that Obama has sought to regulate as he deals with climate change.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to environmental journalist Suzanne Goldenberg. So when we read a quote from the Exxon spokesman saying that Exxon now realizes and that climate change is a reality and is not fighting it, is this disingenuous when we consider that they're still involved with the American Petroleum Institutes of the world and using those organizations as kind of a Trojan horse to fight policy that would shift things into a healthier environment.
You know, there are many, many shades of denial. There are, denial is not just a river in Egypt. You can be a climate denier and just say, well, I am not a scientist. You can be a climate denier and say, well, I'm not questioning the potential. I'm questioning the validity of the science. You can be a climate change denier and say, oh, no, carbon dioxide is good for you. More heat waves, fewer blizzards. Yay. And there's lots of different forms that climate change denial can take. And these big lobby groups in particular are very careful to sort of skate on that very thin border of doubt and denial. But I would say the thing to watch is, to what degree are these big companies on side when it comes to sort of pushing for action on climate change? You know, do they think that it's important to get in there and fight climate change and to have regulations and programs that would fight climate change, or are they hanging back? And I think that's where we need to be looking when we look at denial.
Yes, it seems in some ways hopeful when you hear that Exxon is embracing the reality of climate change, particularly when you take into account Lee Raymond, the former CEO, saying things like, is the earth really warming? Does burning fossil fuels cause global warming? Just really questioning the science. Now it's kind of shifted in. We are not completely sure of man's role in this, but at least we know the earth is warming. So I guess that's progress. But over 20 years, from one of the largest companies in the world that is also a fossil fuel extractor, it would be nice if they could evolve a little more quickly on this, I guess. And now that we know that they knew about this 30-something years ago, it's even more disheartening.
I guess for me, you know, as someone who follows this quite closely, I mean, the issue now is it's not about the science and accepting the science. The real issue here is, you know that climate change is occurring, you know that there's a human cause, so what are you going to do about it? And that's where I think we need to be focusing. What are the big oil companies, the big fossil fuel companies, all the businesses, and you know, elected officials, what are they going to do about climate change?
So you're still working on this issue, Suzanne, correct?
Absolutely. There's still a lot of questions that I have about Exxon and about its involvement in framing the issue of climate change. And I'm going to do what I can to sort of keep digging and hopefully find out more about what Exxon has been up to when it comes to climate change and climate change denial.
Well, you're doing terrific work to expose not only this, but some very important work in the environmental arena. I strongly urge people to follow you on Twitter and to read your pieces on The Guardian. Suzanne Goldenberg, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of the 35th Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, July 17th, 18th, and 19th. The festival is free and family-friendly and runs from 5 to 10 p.m. Friday, noon to 10 p.m. Saturday, 1 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. Sunday. The festival is sponsored by the Jazz Society of Oregon, a nonprofit arts organization. This year, we'll have performances from Haley Newsringer, Robert Moore Orchestra, Paul Creighton Project, a tribute to Stevie Wonder, Alan Jones Academy of Music, Kung Pao Chickens, Portland Youth Jazz Orchestra, LaRonda Steele, the Guitar Masters Finale with Lloyd Jones, Norman Sylvester, Michael Osborne, Jerry Burkholder, and Ben Rice. This is going to be under the St. John's Bridge on the east side of the Willamette River. We'll be broadcasting live from KBOO 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM, all day Saturday. Tune in.
Here comes Chris Andre and Eric Cascadia on KBOO Portland.